When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. Today on the program, we will be discussing Gotham Central, the 2002 series written by Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka and illustrated by Michael Lark. But first, there's a bit of news we need to discuss, Brian.
Yes, there is. And you didn't introduce me, and I'm very sad about that.
Oh, I did forget to. I didn't introduce myself. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Reese.
Hi, I'm Brian Reese. Thank you for introducing me, Paul. It's great to be here. I'm having a wonderful, wonderful late fall, early winter afternoon.
Okay. Wow. We're several episodes in, and you'd think I would have gotten this whole introduction thing down. Apparently not yet. But I guess I'm excited because there's something big has happened, Brian.
Has there? Has something big happened, Paul?
Yes. It turns out a particular writer of comic books has moved over from one company to another.
Gasp.
Yes, and that is that Brian Michael Bendis, a man who has been called one of the architects of modern Marvel Comics, has jumped ship to sign.
What?
Yes, to sign an exclusive deal with DC Comics.
No.
Yes.
Really?
Now, Brian, you are a confessed DC man.
I am a DC man.
And it has been noted on this program that you're not really a Bendis fan.
Bendis!
So how does this sit with you?
Heavy sigh. Well, okay. So, and I think this should be a dialogue between you and I, Paul, not a diatribe by myself. I think that this is actually intriguing. Now, I understand, as you have already pointed out, that I am a DC guy. So the automatic thought that might come out there is, oh, well, you know, Brian's a DC guy, so he's going to be happy with whoever shows up and we'll give them the benefit of the doubt and blah, blah, blah. Sure. I am going to give Brian Michael Bendis the benefit of the doubt. I am happy to welcome him to the DC universe. I have serious issues with Brian Michael Bendis's writing over the past 5, 6, 7, 8 years. But that said, and I think in previous podcasts, I've even confessed, Brian Michael Bendis did amazing work on Daredevil, Alias, early Powers was great. I know it started with Image and then came over to Marvel with their Icon. Who knows where it's going to end up now. But Bendis and his independent stuff, his early stuff before he even came over to Marvel, was he had some really good stuff. And I think it's when... And some people swear by his Spider-Man,
Miles Morales.
Not just Miles Morales, but the early Spider-Man.
The ultimate
Spider-Man with Bagley, Mark Bagley. People swear by that stuff, by that early Spider-Man stuff as like being kind of seminal and kind of great.
Yeah, one of those people is me.
Yes, and sure. I mean, it is the last 5 to 10 years of his career in Marvel where I think a lot of people, including Marvel Zombies, people who are automatically willing to give a writer or artist the benefit of the doubt as long as they're writing for their beloved Marvel, many of those people have felt that Bendis has been skating, right?
Yeah, well, he's had some, I mean, it all... You know, all right. For first of all, I want to say I do like Bendis. I mean, and not everything he does is great, but like as I mentioned on the Miles Morales episode, when Bendis is on his game, he can be one of the best storytellers in comics.
Absolutely.
And when
feel like he has not been in his game, and the reason that I make fun of him and other people make fun of him is that many folks feel like he has not been on his game for a good while now.
But that depends. When he's writing something that he obviously has an affection for, like Miles Morales, those are still good comics. However, his Guardians run is just nothing, basically.
Yeah, I didn't read it.
Yeah, so it's up and down. You know, like I said, when he has an affection for something, it really comes across. And when he's just, you know, a writer for hire, you can tell that he's just skating, like you said. but I'm actually very excited for him moving to DC, because moving to a new company and having new characters and a new environment, that can be a catalyst for real creative growth.
A new sandbox.
Right. And the bottom line is, we as consumers of this medium aren't really concerned with the nuances of the deal he got. We just want good stories.
Right.
And hopefully, what I'm excited about is hopefully that this will provide something that can nudge, you know, his writing style into provide giving us really, really good stories. And maybe it could even nudge Marvel out of its malaise. And you know, by losing one of their top creators, maybe it'll push them to change their ways a little bit. So it could be a win-win on both sides.
It could be. I mean, social media being what it is, I mean, it's been fascinating. Like, I, as someone who is not a big fan of current Bendis, have watched social media with some great amusement over the past 5-6 days, however long this announcement has been out there, with, you get these Marvel people who are like, well, good riddance, now Marvel's going to be saved because Bendis is gone. And you have some other folks who are like, oh no, DC, what were you thinking? They did so much good stuff, and now, oh no, they have Bendis. And this is really weird to me to read this, and my reaction has been sort of contrary to what I think most folks would think my reaction would be, whereas I think people are being kind of douchey on the matter.
Wait, and on social media?
On social media, shocking, I know. And it's strange to me because, like, when they announced it, I thought the first thing I thought of was, wow, what series could I see Bendis writing? That's the first thing I thought of. That's the first thing that came out of my head. It wasn't, what series could Bendis destroy? It was, what series could I see Bendis writing? Will he be reinvigorated, as you mentioned already? And with a different level of creativity, with a different level of editorial overview, with a different, it's everything changes when you put Bendis on a DC title that I would love to see him return to the Bendis that wrote Daredevil, that wrote Alias, that wrote the independent stuff, that wrote even some of the early Avengers stuff. I know people are very cranky about how he changed Avengers.
I liked his Avengers run. I thought it was a lot of fun myself.
Right.
But
the early Ultimate Spider-Man stuff. You know, if we get that Bendis who wants to do that kind of writing, then I'm excited for it. If we get the Bendis that is writing who's just skating like he did the past 5 years or 5 to 10 years, then yeah, that's not so great. But I think the change of venue, you would think as a writer, if you follow like how writers do, when they change the venue or they change the narrative, they usually kind of get a little boost.
Yeah. And that's what I'm thinking, you know.
And I can think of, I mean, a lot of people, I think immediately the first thing people think about is Bendis on Batman. Partly because of how Bendis writes.
Right.
Right.
Sorry, but you've already got Tom King on Batman. You don't need to mess with that.
Well, right, you now don't need to mess with moving Tom King off of Batman, but at the same time, there's actually one series that I think Bendis would be great at, and I don't want to say the name of that series because we're going to talk about it here in a little bit.
Yes, indeed.
Which is why this actually flows very well.
Yeah.
But I can see Bendis in, they're going to have to give him something big. And I don't mind if he writes a Batman comic, because one of my complaints with Batman recently, well, I love Tom King's take on him. I like James Tynion's take on him with Detective and Batman individually. Mm-hmm. What I miss with Batman is Batman as Detective.
Yes.
And
yes, I agree.
And that's okay for other writers to take Batman elsewhere into that realm, in the realm of Batman, because it takes up a lot of space. But what I haven't seen lately is the Batman as detective. Batman, like, on the street, solving crimes. I miss that Batman. And I have long wanted to see a return to that Batman, not necessarily in the main titles, but in some title or in some way, shape, or form with some writer. It strikes me that Bendis would be great at that.
I can't disagree.
He'd be great at a Rene Montoya.
Yes. Comic. You know, similar in vein to a Jessica Jones type of thing.
Right.
Yeah. You know, when, like I said, when he's on it, he can do a really good job with it. And I just think that putting him in this new environment, new characters, a new space, it seems too obvious to give him Batman.
It seems too obvious to give him Batman, but when a writer of Bendis's stature moves from one universe to another, we don't know the details of the deal yet.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you sort of feel like they have to give him something, yeah. Right?
I mean, we got to keep in mind, this is also...
Something big had to pull him over.
Well, you know, that's something we have to keep in mind, is because not only was this just a writing deal, it was also called multifaceted.
Oh, well, there's film.
So yeah. He's going to be in film, he's going to be in the animation, TV, so I think he's going to be everywhere.
Right.
Several of the reports that came out say that, because he was held off of the Marvel, the MCU, he was not allowed to be part of that.
There's some controversy about, like, the restructuring of the film versus comics world in Marvel.
Right.
That Bendis was apparently tossed out.
Yeah, he wasn't even considered to come in as even a consultant. You know, so there's that. There's all the talent leaving, and he considered that. And this is you know, behind the scenes stuff. But apparently, he felt really just left out. That is all his friends were leaving.
All his friends were gone,
and he was discontented by the diversity doesn't sell comments made recently.
Right.
So all those things kind of put together.
Say what they want about Bendis, but you know, he has always attempted to bring in interesting takes.
Yeah. Well, look at his three major creations for
non-traditional takes, I should say.
Yeah. Well, his three major creations for Marvel: Miles Morales, Jessica Jones, and Riri Williams. I mean, that's a pretty diverse cast right there.
You know, two of those are pretty recent.
Well, one's very recent, but Jessica Jones has been around for a decade or more.
Right. But I think Riri and Riri Williams and Miles Morales are relatively recent.
Again, Miles has been around for since mid-2000s, right?
That long?
He's been around for a while. Now, Riri Williams has been is fairly new, but an interesting take on an old character, which, like I said, when Bendis is on, he can do great things.
And drives the fanboys crazy.
Yes. Now, I did hear this, and again, it's an uncredited source from Bleeding Cool, so take it for what you will. But it said that Geoff Johns had nothing to do with the hiring of Brian Bendis, and it's Johns' worst nightmare to have Bendis on board.
Well, except Bleeding Cool also reported that Geoff Johns was instrumental in bringing Bendis over. So,
well, you know, they could cover all angles of a story.
Right. I mean, I'm one of those folks out there who love Bleeding Cool. I love what they do. I think that there's sure a lot of clickbait involved in what they do, but that cat does get some inside information before other folks do. And at the end of the day, it's just a candy site. You know, you read it and you're eating your popcorn reading Bleeding Cool, and that's good. You know, I go to Bleeding Cool every day. I confess it. I will say this unequivocally. I go to Bleeding Cool. I love reading Bleeding Cool. How much I believe on that site doesn't really matter as much as how much I'm entertained by that site.
Fair enough. But here's one of the speculations, not from Bleeding Cool, it's from someone else. There is speculation that he will be allowed to draw again, because Bendis did start off as a writer-illustrator.
And, his early stuff, the stuff that has been published by Image or whatnot, Goldfish and Torso, stuff like that was his art.
And Quesada never refused to allow him to draw, which I don't understand that, but maybe it has to do with, you know, getting things out on time. I don't know.
I mean, you know, it's when you're drawing, this isn't 1967, you know, it's how art is presented is different now, and it takes longer to put that to page. So I'm one of those folks who doesn't have a problem with delays or what have you, or this idea that artists should be doing 3 comics a month.
Yeah, but you know, back in the day, Kirby was doing what, 12?
I thought he was doing like 40 or 50. But if you listen to fanboys, Kirby was drawing 50 comics a month, and shame on all these other artists now who can't get one comic done in a 30-day period because Kirby did 50.
Yeah, well, first of all, that's not true. He didn't do 50. He did do a lot, and he was pretty damn good at it. You know, it was a completely different time. There's no comparison between them.
You had, you know, it was four color versus whatever's happening now. I mean, some folks are way more informed about how art is currently produced in the comics and what have you. But
yeah, you can't make that comparison. I think it's unfair.
If someone was taking 15 days to draw a 22-page comic or 20-page comic now, their art would suffer, and fanboys would be bitching and moaning about how the art was terrible.
Well, regardless, I think that if somehow part of this deal, Bendis is allowed to draw again, I think that's really intriguing. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. Maybe Vertigo is going to be the place where he ends up. I know there's some creators' rights issues there. I know that his Icon stuff for Marvel has now been pulled down off of Comixology. So it'll be interesting to see where that pops back up again. Is it going to be under Vertigo? Is DC going to do a true, honest-to-goodness, creator-owned line that will cater to the Brian Michael Bendises of the world? I don't know. We don't know. All of the information we have is very sketchy right now. Yeah. It's going to be like 4 or 5 months before we even hear about Bendis's first project with DC. Right.
I'm sure they're still working it out too.
Right.
Just hope.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say on the other side, I hope Marvel doesn't get, you know, pull some kind of bitter, rejected boyfriend kind of thing. I just hope they don't get nasty towards Bendis and his creations.
Are you suggesting that, are you asking for Marvel not to get nasty about DC?
Hey, you know,
Marvel has
not,
been
not and not, and it, you know, what, I think you over-exaggerate that, but there are some aspects, especially in management of Marvel, that do get nasty, but it's not a systemic company-wide thing.
Oh, what?
I don't know. I don't think it is.
Marvel have been pieces of shit to DC over the past, what, 15 years? From Quesada to Brevoort to Slott to Bendis himself to all of their creators and editors, Nick Spencer. My God, the level of nastiness that Marvel has slung at DC over the years has been, it's documented. It's out there. You don't have to try very hard to hear all of the kind of nasty shit that people in charge at Marvel have said about DC. Whereas, say what you want about Dan Didio or any of the DC folks, but they always took the high ground on this stuff. So, okay. Yeah, I don't, you know, I, yes, you're right. I could see Marvel being a little shitty about this, but it would not be out of character for Marvel.
Okay.
Anyway. And this comes from somebody who wants Marvel to succeed as much as DC, because when Marvel and DC both succeed, we all win. Wow. I would also like to add to the Bendis thing, in terms of DC getting some new talent, you have also seen, Paul, I'm guessing, that DC has made an offer to Jonathan Hickman.
Yes, I did see that Hickman was courted.
Yes.
But I didn't know what any of the details were, so I didn't want to... You know.
By all accounts, he has submitted stories and DC or submitted ideas, and DC has made him an offer, and the last we have seen is that Hickman is contemplating.
That would not surprise me. The overall feeling of Marvel Comics in the past year especially has it's just not been conducive for big names to stay with them. You know, but my feeling, when I was saying, like, you know,
well,
I hope
Hickman,
they don't get...
Hickman left Marvel years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon for writers to go back and forth and back and forth.
Right.
I don't think, you know, and Bendis leaving to go write for DC isn't in itself a huge deal. It's the fact that he's doing it exclusively for DC.
Right.
So he's basically just saying, you know, screw Marvel. I'm not even going to consider writing for you anymore. That's the, you know... This is sort of like, I don't want to say it's the level of the Kirby defection back in the early 70s, right, but it's up there.
It's up there because How long has, I don't have the number in front of me, but Bendis has been with Marvel and has been sort of synonymous with Marvel for 15, 18 years?
I got to be back in 2000, right? When they did the big retooling?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's a long time. We're looking close to two decades. I'm not going to say it's two decades. Our fact checkers out there will let us know for certain.
I'm pretty sure he was there when Geoff Johns was still there.
Possibly.
So that was a long time ago. No, but he was, you know, like I said, he was considered one of the new architects of the retooled, redesigned, all new, all different Marvel.
Right.
And that little renaissance that they had in the early 2000s, that had a lot to do with Bendis. I mean, you know, Brubaker and Fraction and so forth had things to say about it as well.
You said Geoff Johns. It's akin to Geoff Johns bolting to Marvel in terms of longevity and impact on a line-wide sort of idea within, you know, any given publisher is, you know, Geoff Johns is so valuable to DC. And for a long time, Brian Michael Bendis was valuable to Marvel in the same way that we think of Geoff Johns being valuable to DC now.
Right. I just hope, you know, because Bendis has exclusively written for Miles Morales and Jessica Jones. I'm pretty sure. I could be wrong about Jessica Jones, but I'm pretty sure he's the only one who wrote for those two characters.
And people are kind of upset. Fans of those characters are a little upset because they don't know what's going to happen to those characters.
Exactly.
Now that Bendis left.
Now, I think the right thing to do is...
I think he's still wrapping some stuff up, though.
Well, he has said that, and this is probably throw you over the edge again, but Bendis himself tweeted, overjoyed to tell you that the insanely classy, cool Tom Brevoort and Nick Lowe are making the transition with grace and generosity and allowed me final moments with my characters.
Well, that's nice. I'm not sure if the term classy has ever been used in terms of Tom Brevoort at all before. So, okay.
That's what I thought was going to send you over the edge. So.
Well, can you think of an instant where Brevoort has ever been considered called classy in the past?
No, I don't put much thought into him, to be honest with you. I think now what that says to me is he's going to wrap up these characters or at least wrap up his story arcs.
Let's hope so.
Before leaving. Now, if Marvel was smart, they'd kind of put them aside for a little bit instead of just handing them to a new creator, but they are going to hand it to a new creator.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Sure. It would be nice if there was some sort of agreement. You know, it's like in the same way Neil Gaiman gets a first pass or first allowance when his characters are used in DC. Yeah. I understand Bendis is not at Gaiman level, but at the same time, be nice if someone in 2 years, someone says, hey, Brian Michael Bendis, I'm going to be writing Miles Morales. Do I have your blessing?
Yes.
If not your blessing, can you at least read this script and say, hey, this is good? Marvel doesn't have to do that. Brian Michael Bendis doesn't have to do that. Whoever's going to be tapped to write that doesn't have to do that. Nobody has to do that. It's not required, but it is a nice thing.
Well, it's a creator courtesy.
Yeah, it's a courtesy.
Yeah. So, you know, it would be nice if that happened. My feelings are they're probably just going to give those characters to second tier talent. My faith in Marvel has been shaken.
Al Ewing is just waiting in the wings, or Charles Soule. Oh, they're just going to give it to Charles Soule, isn't it? Because he can write like 20 comics a month, and all of them sound and read the exact same. But he's Charles Soule, so he'll write 20 a month, and there's your money.
Well, overall, though, like I said before, I do think Bendis going to this new company will be the impetus for a new little renaissance in his career. And I'm excited to see where it goes.
And I'm on your side in that. I would like to see that happen as well. So as much negative that I've had to say about Bendis over the past few years, I am hoping as a DC fanboy and a fan of good comics and a fan of Daredevil that you are correct.
Yeah. So
I'm rooting for him. I am on record now saying I'm rooting for Brian Michael Bendis.
Very good.
Write this down in your calendar.
So instead of Bendis, it's going to be Bendis.
Yes. Although, given time, it could end up being Bendis again.
But you know what? Like you said, we all just love good comics. And, you know, we each have our preferences, but overall, we just want a good story.
Yes.
Okay. I think that wraps up this section. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, Gotham Central.
Woo!
Batman Nightcast, a thrilling new podcast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network, hosted by Ryan Daly
and Chris Franklin. Nightcast chronicles the Caped Crusaders' adventures in Batman and Detective Comics after Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Highlights from this legendary era include
Batman number 400,
Legends,
Mike Barr and Alan Davis,
Batman Year 1,
Batman Year 2,
Max Allen Collins, the new Jason Todd, Millennium?
You're not doing this right. Let me take over. Alan Grant and Norm Breyfogle.
Alan Grant from Jurassic Park?
Did you hear me say Norm freaking Breyfogle?
Oh, yeah.
Son of the Demon.
The Killing Joke.
A Death in the Family.
Batman Year 3.
A Lonely Place of Dying.
Alan Grant, Alan Davis, Max Allen Collins. Why are there so many people named Alan from this era of Batman?
The Rise of Tim Drake.
Legends of the Dark Knight.
And that's just up until 1989.
Did anything exciting happen with Batman after that?
You'll have to tune in to find out.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Find it on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Oh, we forgot to mention your favorite issue, when Batman fires Dick Grayson.
You want to find another co-host?
And we're back. Today on the program, we will be discussing Gotham Central. But Brian, this is your recommendation, so take it away, Brian.
Okay, so this is, yes, my recommendation. So Gotham Central is a hard-boiled DC series in all its noir glory, written by Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka, illustrated by Michael Lark, and published from 2002 to 2006. The series revolves around the ground-level work of the Gotham Police Department, focusing on the MCU, or the Major Crimes Unit, originally formed by former Commissioner James Gordon. Within that context, Batman is a minor, though important, player, with much of the series focusing on the procedural nature of the actual non-powered cops and detectives as they solve crimes, live their personal lives, and react to the superhuman nature of the world around them. The arcs we are concentrating on are the two-issue In the Line of Duty, written by both Brubaker and Rucka, Motive, a three-issue arc written by Ed Brubaker, and the seminal Half a Life, written by Greg Rucka, comprising issues 6 through 10. Without too many spoilers at this point, this spate of comics involves the Gotham City Police Department and Major Crimes Unit investigating a kidnapping, dealing with the horrific death of one of their own, taking on Two-Face, Mr. Freeze, and Firebug, and coming to grips with corruption within their own ranks. The streets of Gotham are riddled with characters, and the MCU offers no less amount of equal characters themselves. The Half-A-Life arc itself contains one of the most important storylines in contemporary comics. And that is basically as brief a description of this comic as I could come up with.
Well, it's very brief, but it's concise and direct to the point. I understand you don't want to give away spoilers just in case someone hasn't actually read this series just yet.
Right, because there are some pretty important things that happen, and even in the smaller arcs that I think would, I didn't want to go into too much detail.
Okay,
with so, actual, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so we do want to, not something we normally do, but do a little brief non-spoiler and then spoiler conversation right after that?
Sure. Or we could just indicate to folks that there are some prominent spoilers that are going to follow in the actual discussion. So, yeah. You know, you've been warned. Some of these spoilers you will already know, folks will already know at this point that they've been paying attention to DC Comics, particularly the Gotham level part of the comics going forward. But I did want to not give away too much in my introduction in case folks would like to read on their own these particular issues without having too many surprises.
Yeah, and that's understandable. Because this is a really fantastic and compelling read, which, you know, let's just say that up front. If you haven't read this, go and read this, because this is good stuff right here.
Right.
And, all right, before we get into everything, I just want to make my one little point. I wish the series Gotham was this and not what it is. Now, to be fair, I've only seen what, the first two episodes of Gotham, and then I haven't watched another. So
wow, so you're like four seasons behind.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was not impressed, so I moved on.
Well, I think so, everybody. So folks know, yeah, the original intent of the TV series Gotham was to fall in line with Gotham Central, the comic. I think the original intent was to mirror the comic a little more closely than they ended up doing.
But then it got Foxified.
It got Foxified, and it got TV-ified, and it got corporatified, and what have you. But the intent of Gotham, the series, does hold with the series Gotham Central, in that the series is, the overall intent is to deal with the street level, as it were. I mean, we talk about Marvel with their street level, Daredevil and Luke Cage and Jessica Jones and whatnot. And Gotham Central originally was, long before Marvel attempted this, Gotham Central was DC's attempt to deal with Gotham from the vantage point of the folks who actually live day to day.
Well, it shows that Gotham is a real living city, and there's a lot more going on besides villains and heroes duking it out. I mean, there are families and people with careers, and people just simply living their lives without wanting to be involved in the meta-human situation and the craziness that goes with it.
And there actually is a police department in Gotham that actually has to do procedural crime solving on a day-to-day basis.
Right. Yeah, it's Law and Order Gotham.
It's very much Law and Order Gotham, which is a fair, that is a fair statement.
So when we move into spoilers, I'll just play the little dun-dun. So Brian, what is it about this this particular series that you wanted to recommend?
Well, I think it starts off with my love of, which I think has been discussed earlier, and probably folks have caught up on, is my love of the sort of hard-boiled noirish crime stories that I tend to gravitate towards. It's a genre that I love both in regular novelization and in comics as well. And I think that when you have two writers who, in Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka, who excel probably more than any other writers in comics in recent history in this type of storytelling, and you have them both collaborating on a series that does play on those aspects, I think, first of all, you have to, I think everybody had to pay attention to the fact that, you know, we've got Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucka writing a street level comic. And in Michael Lark's great art, I know I recommended a comic with Michael Lark two podcasts ago. What's fascinating is Michael Lark completely changes his art in Gotham Central. It's a complete turnabout from what he did with Terminal City, which we talked about earlier.
I want to just reiterate what you were saying, is that both Brubaker and Rucka, they excel at this noir procedural detective story.
Yeah.
And everything about it, the way the panels move, the dialogue, they're amazing at it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a style that neither of the big two really visit very often.
Right. And the funny thing is, but these stories don't really need to be Batman stories. They're great detective stories in and of themselves, but having that extra added level of Batman lingering in the background just gives it something unique and special.
Well, I think the existence of Batman is actually a character in and of itself. Not Batman, but the existence of Batman is a character within these stories. Because it informs how the detectives and how the police go about their business. And there are numerous moments within this series where Batman is discussed. He does show up. He shows up in a couple of the arcs. Twice he, quote unquote, saves the day, to the aggravation of the cops who have worked long, hard hours to solve said crime, that then Batman shows up at the last minute, saves the day, and there is definitely a rift.
Yeah. I'm going to. I have something to say in detail about that, especially in the second. Well, in the second arc when we get there. But first of all, it sheds an interesting light on the whole idea of vigilantism. This is the cop's job, and and it shows not really disrespect, but maybe disdain. The disdain that the cops have for Batman doing their job for them, and not only that, but kind of doing it better than them.
I know. Well, and sometimes.
Go
ahead.
Yeah, no, but them having to step aside, you know, in deference to him, you know, that annoyance is palatable. It's something that kind of shadows the entire story.
It's almost like the shadow of the bat.
Almost. But yeah, when we get into details about Half-Life, I'll have something more to say about that.
Well, and I think there's numerous situations, not counting Half-Life or what have you, that where the cops actually do the actual work, and then Batman comes in at the last minute, and perhaps in Half-Life is what you're referring to when Batman shows up, pretends to be a cop, gets all the relevant information from the cops who actually did the work to get the information, and then rushes in and saves the day.
Right.
Is that where you're going with that?
Yes, a little bit more than that.
Well, we could work our way to that.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know if I should be putting that in this, you know, are we doing spoilers?
Well, I think we've already given spoilers. We've already told people that spoilers are going to follow. So.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So, yeah. Spoilers. So
We're fully into spoiler level now. If you're listening to this and you haven't been warned the 5 or 10 times that we've already said spoilers, this is your last chance.
Exactly.
Abandon hope, all ye who enter at this point, because we're full on spoilers now.
Well, having said that, I think that first of all, this series, I mentioned Law and Order. I think it's much more, it has more akin to the Wire than anything else, because it's very street level, very down and dirty.
Yeah. It's a little less of the law. And it's actually a little more of the law and less of the order. There's less of the procedural. The procedural is on the policing side as opposed to lawyer side or the prosecution side.
Exactly. To get into much more of the personal lives of the detectives, much more like how The Wire does than you would in, say, Law and Order. All right. That being said, I guess let's start from the beginning. Because the first arc,
let's clarify real quick. The first arc was written by, it's two issues, and it was written by both Greg Rucka and Ed Brubaker together. And that's important going forward, because then Rucka and Brubaker took individual arcs on themselves.
Now, is that the entire run? They went back and forth between Brubaker writing a story, then Rucka, then Brubaker?
Pretty much. I mean, it changes here and there. I mean, there's a couple where you could tell they're co-writing,
yeah.
But for the most part, they were both playing off of each other, and they did it so well. I mean, it's a dream to imagine those two writing together again.
Oh, yeah. The stories interweave with one another. Beautiful. But that first arc, the big bad is Mr. Freeze. And the thing that struck me the most is, in just two issues, it made Mr. Freeze incredibly dangerous.
Yes.
You know, normally you see, you know, his methods are simply to, in a normal Mr. Freeze story, you freezes somebody, they thaw, and you very rarely get repercussions. But in this story, the repercussions are horrifying.
Yes.
I mean, it's some really gruesome stuff.
And again, spoilers off, but... we could tell people. I mean, the first two issues basically deal with two detectives, Marcus Driver and Fields. It deals with. We start off the arc with two detectives investigating a kidnapping, or what they think is a kidnapping.
They get a tip, but they don't even think they're just routinely checking in on this tip. They don't even think it's going to amount to anything.
And what happens is that one of the detectives is then, they encounter Mr. Freeze in the apartment that they thought they would find this kidnapped girl. And Mr. Freeze basically freezes, as he does, one of the detectives. And he doesn't just freeze them, he then...
breaks them in half.
Breaks them, not in half, but in hundreds of pieces.
Oh, yeah.
This is a street level detective who is frozen and broken into hundreds of pieces.
Yeah. And then later you get one of Mr. Freeze's thugs, if you want to call it that, is done away with by having his insides frozen.
Frozen from the inside frozen out.
From the inside out, which is just nasty. It's gruesome.
You're right.
It's awful.
But this is the type of thing that you don't get in sort of the larger scale Batman comics.
Right.
And you don't see the consequences. You don't see how it affects. So Marcus Driver is the partner of the character, the cop's last name is Fields, who is frozen and then broken into hundreds of pieces. We also meet his wife later, who works in the morgue of all places. But in the main series, you don't get how that affects folks going forwards. And Marcus Driver, like through the next, basically through the series, this affects Marcus. Marcus Driver is one of the detectives of tens of 20s of detectives that are featured in the series. But Marcus Driver, this affects him basically throughout the entire series, the entire run.
Yeah, as it would, because that's... Yeah. It's a horrible thing to have happen. Yeah, so, and then the next arc after that follows Fields again as he tries to solve this kidnapping case. And there's a separate storyline going on with someone, an arsonist.
What I think it's important to note throughout the entire thing, there are numerous stories going on throughout all of these arcs. Some of them are resolved by the end of each arc, but some of them are built up to be visited later on.
Mm-hmm.
You see many stories percolating.
Well, like any great procedural, a police procedural, there's many different cases going on. We happen to be focusing on one, like, you know, the case of the week in this particular arc, but the arc continually shows the board. So you know that there's other things going on. And as the series progresses, we weave in and out of those other cases and those other detectives.
I would also like to insert real quickly that you mentioned the board. It's the unsolved cases. And somewhere in there you have warrants. And it's listing all the people who have outstanding warrants. But, the duty board, basically, I think is... Under the warrants, you have a whole list of, like, DC creators' last names, which is a nice little Easter egg. But within there is a character... there is a warrant out for someone whose last name is Bendis.
Well, they finally got their man.
Yes. So back in 2002, there was a warrant out in DC for a gentleman named Bendis.
I didn't notice that, but excellent, good eye.
Yeah, that was it's detective work, Paul.
Excellent.
I did detective work.
You detected that. You detected the shit out of that.
I detected the shit out of that.
But
we could do like a 10-minute Bendis dialogue here about it.
I think we've already done that. But something about these stories that I guess should be. I want to reiterate, is that there's an aspect of storytelling that gets lost in comics when you deal only from the perspective of a superhero or a supervillain. Right. I mean, they always pay lip service to protecting the people, but people are always portrayed as incidental, you know?
Yes.
You know, like just something off to the side. This story gives them a voice, and you can see them as real people with personalities and lives, and it just adds such an extra dynamic to something like Batman,
right? And I think one of the things I should have highlighted at the start is that it's a vast amount of characters. I can't even remember all the name of the detectives that are introduced. I mean, it's a full squad. You know, the Major Crimes Unit is a full squad.
There's a huge cast of characters, and they all are unique. They all have their own unique voice, which is really impressive. Especially someone like he's not the commissioner. Who is he? The lieutenant, I guess, who comes in and he always has these little fact tidbits that he's talking about.
Oh, Probson?
Yeah. He's always right.
He's the night shift. He's the commander of the night shift. Is that who you're talking about?
Yeah, he's the fellow who keeps coming in and he always has some tidbit of information, some little trivia that he's talking about. So, but basically you get his personality, even though he's not the center of attention.
Right.
He just sort of comes in, from his dialogue, you understand this guy. You understand what his personality is and how he interacts with everybody. Yeah.
And make no mistake, there's a lot of dialogue. And I think Rucka and Brubaker like have definitely experts on writing dialogue.
Oh yeah. And this gets to Michael Lark in his artwork as well. There are moments of no dialogue that kind of give the moments with dialogue that punch.
Right.
So you'll see a bunch of detectives talking to each other kind of around the subject. They're not talking about something directly. And then there'll be a panel of them just kind of staring at each other or looking at the floor. And you get that emotion and that feel for things unsaid, literally and figuratively. It's really quite well done.
So yes, as we've talked about, like all of the sort of various and sundry characters and dialogue and whatnot, let me get back into, because I really want to do half a life is where I really want to concentrate on, and particularly Renee Montoya and her relationship ultimately with, and here's the first of two spoilers, her relationship with Two-Face. In the No Man's Land arc in Batman back in the day, Renee Montoya developed a relationship with Harvey Dent, a.k.a. Two-Face. She and her family developed a relationship with Two-Face, and Two-Face developed a, let's say, unhealthy attraction to Renee Montoya. And in Half a Life, the arc is essentially Two-Face attempting to destroy Renee Montoya's career with the Gotham City Police Department and the Major Crimes Unit in order to have Renee Montoya to himself.
Now, I want to point out, I had not read that previous story arc, so the introduction of Two-Face kind of at the end seemed a little disjointed to me at first. Now, I'm talking about when I first read this years ago. So I remember when I first read it, that introduction of Two-Face sort of seemed a bit odd. But I mean, now that I have the whole history, it makes a lot more sense.
Right.
It didn't take away from the story. I don't want to say that. It just sort of said, oh wow, they just threw Two-Face in here for some reason.
Right, and it is a little, again, as you said, it's a little offsetting if you don't know how Harvey Dent came to be obsessed with Renee Montoya, but you also, I think it is very well established in later issues when he is actually introduced as the character who was attempting to frame her. And I think that Rucka appropriately wrote via dialogue the obsession with her in a way that one did not need to know the history to know that he was, to understand his obsession with her.
Yes, I agree. That's what I was trying to get at. It didn't take away from the story. It just, his introduction is pretty abrupt. There's nothing leading up to it. It just sort of, oh, and it's Two-Face. But having that whole story, having the whole backstory gives it an extra depth, but you don't really need to know that.
Sure.
Like I said, it doesn't take away from it. But I think the big gist, the reason this story gets its accolades is because of the way it handled a lesbian relationship, and specifically being forcibly outed.
Right. Yeah. Basically, Renee Montoya is outed via a complex procedural that involved a former criminal. So, in the process of trying to take control of Renee Montoya, Two-Face frames her for a crime, uses internal affairs and a corrupt member of internal affairs to essentially...
It frames her. They frame her. They first of all, they find out her biggest secret, which is that she was a lesbian, she was closeted, and they out her in front of not only her entire squad, but also her family, who is a very Catholic family, Dominican Republic, and also frames her to make it look like she committed a crime that she did not do. But it's the emotional, and all of this is pretty straightforward for a detective story. It's nothing we haven't heard before, but the aspect of her being outed and her emotional reaction to that is what makes this story special.
Yes.
Now, and for the time it was written, no one, I don't want to say no one was doing something like this, but it was very,
this was new.
It was new. Exactly.
In the way that it was approached.
Right. To the point where this storyline won several awards, an Eisner Award for best serialized story, a Harvey Award, and a Galactic Spectrum Award, which until I was researching this, had no idea that existed. So this really, really had an impact when it was released. Now, that being said, and this is probably going to differ from most people's perception of this story. I think this story would have worked better if Batman wasn't in it.
Well, you did have that moment where Batman again comes in to save the day at the end.
I mean, all the characters in this story are well-rounded. They have their motivations. We know their idiosyncrasies, their secrets. And plus, they're also competent. They're good at their jobs. It just felt like Batman swooping in at the last moment was a Dark Knight ex machina, if you will. it sort of takes Renee Montoya's authority away. That was the impression that I got. He cuffs all the thugs, he captures Two-Face, and I would have rather her made the decision.
She was made as the victim when they could have, she could have been more empowered. And she was to a point, because she was about to kill Harvey Dent before Batman shows up.
Right. Well, that's in part of it, because Batman says it could only end one of two ways. He would have killed you or you would have killed him. I couldn't let that happen. But he makes the decision for her. Just reading that, I would have rather her made the decision to not kill or do it.
She later on in the series, she gets that choice again.
Yes, but I'm trying to focus just on this one storyline. Right. Yeah. And that was the impression that I got when I first read it. It would have been, I'm not trying to take anything away from the storyline. It is incredible. It's really well done, and it's
heartbreaking. I mean, her relationship with her parents when she's outed, the great scene with her and Maggie Sawyer, who we all know Maggie Sawyer comes into play in DC. Maggie Sawyer is the day shift, is the chief of the day shift, and Maggie Sawyer also has some advice for Renee Montoya when Renee Montoya is outed as well. But and then the relationship that she has with her partner Crispus Allen, you know, it builds up a lot of tension. I think.
Oh yeah,
and the tension doesn't go away. But the introduction of Batman at the end kind of cuts into that tension.
Yeah, see, it would have been nice if maybe he let the other detectives arrest the thugs, and instead of him kind of swooping in and tying things up in a nice bow for everybody.
But it's kind of the point of the series.
Yeah, it is.
You know, because there's numerous conversations throughout. I mean, there's a lot of dialogue in this series, and there's numerous conversations where, you know, the officers complain or build up Batman, either mythologically or there's a lot of resentment.
Yes, absolutely.
To Batman solving crimes. So every time, or solving their crimes or coming in at the last minute. And I think that this series plays that up a lot in terms of the disappointment when Batman shows up after they've done all the work.
Exactly. Yes, and seemingly takes all the credit for their hard work.
Right.
But overall, I just, this series in general, not only this first volume, but also the entire run of the series, it is groundbreaking.
Yes.
It was incredibly well done by two, you know, seminal writers in comics and a fabulous artist that really gave a life and a mood to their writing. It's definitely something. It's definitely one of the classic comic book series that deserves to be read by pretty much everyone who's a comic book fan.
Absolutely, and particularly if you're a fan of the procedural and the noirish nature.
Yes, we didn't even get into how the noir feel, the hard boiled detective genre, which you touched on briefly,
which is prevalent throughout. Yeah,
right. Should we wrap this up, Ryan?
Yes. Anyway, so that was Gotham Central, and I think Paul and I both highly recommend it. So, absolutely. In 2 weeks, we're going to talk about another comic book series.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, Paul, if you have a comic book series that you would like to talk about next time.
There is, in fact, something I'd like to talk about next time, Ryan. My recommendation for next time is, in keeping with my trend to tie things into a theme or a current event, not planning that, but apparently that's what I'm doing now. I'm nothing if not a slave to trends. It will be Thor by Walter Simonson, Volume 1. Now, this collects Thor number 337 to 345, and it is one of, if not the best runs of Thor ever written. And I mean, by that, I mean the entirety of Simonson's run.
It's the entirety of Simonson's
run
is pretty amazing.
He was able to incorporate Kirby style with 80s style, while at the same time adding some of his own unique style on top of that. Plus, Beta Ray Bill.
So we're talking about a very specific story arc within Walter Simonson's overall Thor arc. Am I correct?
Yes. This is his... The Marvel released a series of volumes of just Walter Simonson. And the volume is actually called Thor by Walter Simonson, Volume 1. And this then goes from 337 to 345.
Okay.
It's good stuff.
I know the arc of which you speak, and I'm looking forward to talking about it.
Excellent. So I guess that's it. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And until next time, keep reading comics.
Be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the hashtag #CollectedEdition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?